Okay, so the source sheets are in the middle. I guess if anyone else straggles in, there'll be plenty in the middle. Where we left off last time, I think it's going to lead well into what we discussed this time, which is to say that we concluded last time. Well, what we did last time was we sort of investigated the conventional wisdom for the origins of the synagogue, which we identified as placing the origins in the aftermath of the destruction of Bais Rishon, the first temple, on the assumption that with the implosion of a public communal place of worship and a culture that defined itself by that place of worship, by the Beis HaMikdash, the Jewish people needed to reconstitute their culture of worshiping and davening and serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu in exile. And the way that they did that was by forming shuls. And we pointed in particular to a famous source in the Bavli, which the Rishonim all quote, and which has become, as we'll see today actually, really very much a part of the lexicon, at least in the way that our community, and I think many Jewish communities, Orthodox or not, talk about the shul. And that source in the Bavli has been co-opted in many respects by historians to point to Babylonia, sort of post-First Temple Babylonia, as the place of origin for the synagogues. In particular, that source identifies the words Mikdash Ma'at in the Pasuk in Yechezkel, where God comforts the Jewish people by telling them that he'll be with them in the exile. That phrase, Mikdash Ma'at, has been identified as meaning shul, and it's an expression of God's insistence that the Jewish people have a place of worship in the exile. We discussed that conventional wisdom. First of all, we pointed out that Mikdash Ma'at, in the simple meaning of the verse, actually certainly can't mean shul. We pointed out how it's unlikely that that was the origin of the synagogue. And then we discussed the archaeology, the earliest sources that we have for the existence of synagogues, and we pointed out that as the synagogues, the Greek word that we used for it, that we pointed out is in all the earliest sources for synagogues, prosauche, Greek word which means sort of basically a place of prayer. So we know what went on in the earliest synagogue. So we identified the early synagogue as actually being quite different from the Beis HaMikdash. And it seems unlikely, in fact, that the institution of the synagogue, to the extent that it has some sort of coherent development, developed in any way out of imitating the Beis HaMikdash. This is basically the synagogue in its earliest iteration was actually not a Mikdash Ma'at in a literal sense. It took on this meaning as the functions developed and as Chazal began to think about what the shul could be or should be. What I'd like to do this time is actually transition from that discussion to, I think, a broader discussion of what Jewish society would have looked like during this period. And in particular, I want to address the question of uniformity. As we're going to see, I think, a little bit more at the end of this class, there is a sense in which I think many in our community hold this romanticized view of Jewish history in which, in an early period, the people are sort of united in purpose and in practice in their observance of Jewish law and their beliefs, and they're for the most part under the rule of the leadership, the aegis of rabbis. And then eventually, as history proceeds, things begin to fragment until we reach the stage of history in which we're in, which is either denominational or post-denominational or what have you. What I'd like to show is that, in fact, the earliest phases of Jewish history and the earliest places where we could begin to see the rise of rabbis or people who would eventually become rabbis actually is much more typical of what we know today, which is to say a very diverse communal experience in which rabbis and Jewish leadership are actually asked not to lead the Jewish people, or they're not actually being tasked with leading the Jewish people, but instead they are envisioning what the world would be like if they were leading the Jewish people. And in particular, they're trying to bring halachic Torah order to what is in many respects chaos. So we can hopefully, over the course of this class, explore what it means to have a halacha-based culture, to have a Torah-based culture that is loyal to rabbinic literature in the midst of an incredibly diverse culture that doesn't always see rabbinic literature as authoritative, as many in the Jewish world, as most people in the Jewish world today, in one sense or another, do not. The Orthodox community is idiosyncratic in this respect.
What traditions within the halakhic tradition itself? People had different.
So I'm not talking about even within the halakhic tradition. And by halakhic tradition, I mean the masorah as we understand it. I mean the Jewish world outside of the rabbinic masorah, which is what we know to be the binding halakha. So what I'd like to talk about is what the world would have looked like if you consider Chazal, or the early progenitors of Chazal, as one piece of a much larger puzzle. And what does that tell us, first of all, about what the project of Chazal was, how that should help us understand contemporary Psak, and also how that should help us structure our own expectations for how rabbinic authority or Jewish leadership should look like in a contemporary world. So what I'd like to do is use one particular aspect of the early development of the shul, the synagogue, to discuss all of these issues. And in particular, what I want to focus on is, first of all, the presence of different people in the shul and how that would have been dealt with. So as the title of this class betrays, what I want to talk about is the machitza in the early synagogue. The machitza, as I'm sure many of you are aware, ended up becoming, in sort of the wars between Orthodoxy and its opposing denominations, machitza has become, or was in many respects, a major buzzword. It was a lightning rod. It was something that became a boundary line that divided Orthodox rabbis from non-Orthodox rabbis. It became a sticking point for people like Rabbi Soloveitchik, for people like Rav Moshe Feinstein, for Rabbi Lamb, and so on and so forth. So the issue of where the machitza originates, is there a machitza in ancient times, has actually become a point of contention. A consensus has basically developed in the practice, in this practice of Jewish history, which is in many respects influenced, I think, by people who were themselves of the conservative movement, so this is no mistake, but a consensus has basically developed. Although it's not always true, but in many respects, the consensus is developed in Jewish history that asserts that there was no such thing as separate seating, or certainly any sort of machitza, let alone separate seating. No such thing as separate seating or a machitza in the ancient synagogue. No such thing never existed.
And assume that women came.
So we have to actually, if we want to assess this consensus and figure out what, in fact, the reality may have been. Maybe that was the reality, maybe it wasn't, and either way, what are the implications of this? But I think you're right to point out that we actually have to step back, and if we want to assess that consensus, ask ourselves what sort of assumptions are being built into that consensus. So one that we can identify is, well, if we want to ask the question, was there a machitza in an ancient synagogue? Was there separate seating in an ancient synagogue? We have to ask ourselves a prior question. Was there a need, right? Who was in the ancient synagogue? Who was there?
That's a good question. 300 to 1,000.
Right. So good question. Excellent question. Let's give some sort of chronological temporal boundaries to our discussion. So what we looked at last week, the earliest sources that we have for synagogues are earliest stages, probably 3rd, 2nd century before the Common Era in Egypt. The earliest time that we can start, I think, to look at actual remains of synagogues so we can analyze them archaeologically are going to be from a substantially later period. As we're going to see at the end of near the end of this class, we're going to look at one synagogue in particular, whose existence spans a period of about 400 years from 200 to 600 of the Common Era. So there is a long period that we're considering. The sources that we're going to consider, and I provided dates for you on the source sheet for this very purpose, can allow you to see every time we look at a source exactly where we are in history. But you'll see the basic boundary of what we're going to be looking at is about the 1st century before the Common Era through, let's say, the 5th or the 6th century of the Common Era. The source sheets are in the middle here. Yes?
If there were no synagogue in Babylonia, how did they express their Jewishness or retain their sense of community?
Right, excellent question, Mr. Kram. Actually, Mr. Blank asked a similar question last week, or he rather asserted there must have been something. So I don't want to be dogmatic about this. There may have been synagogues in Babylonia after the collapse of the First Temple Society. We don't know that there were, and we don't really have any evidence that there were. But it's certainly possible that there were. The question is of how Jews maintain their identity, and the evidence, archaeological and textual, suggests very strongly that they actually did very much, and also anomalously retain their identity, is a good question. I think we have to question our assumption about whether or not the only way to maintain Jewish identity in a post-temple society is via local institutions like synagogues. Maybe that's not the case, and it may be that our failure to imagine an alternative represents just that, a failure of imagination. But you're right, there must have been something. I just don't know what it is.
But they had the schools of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. So, you know, they weren't synagogues. They were, you know, academies of learning.
Ah.
So we don't know, you know, what was going on in Babylonia. They may have had the same academies of learning. It may not have been designated as a shul. But it was,
right.
It was a, you
know. So I have a long-term project, or a long-term vision for this class. And one of the things I want to eventually get to is the rise of academies. The Fia Nias Daiti, sort of my humble opinion, is that academies as such, in other words, academies as, when I say academy, I mean sort of an institution of learning, which includes a building and an official bureaucracy and a leadership structure, like as such, doesn't arise until a much later period, and only then, really, in late sort of Babylonia, and then also eventually in Eretz Yisrael. But this is not till several hundred years later. Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, I think, represent not academies in that sense. They represent what we might call study circles. In other words, there's a charismatic figure who's a Talmud Chacham, and he attracts students who sit with him and learn with him. It's not a build, and I don't even necessarily think it would have taken place in an institutional building like the Jewish Center, for instance. It might have taken place in somebody's home. If you look in some of the early sources that we have for how study was done, or how learning was done, or where learning took place in the early stages of rabbinic literature, so often in the Mishnah you'll encounter things being done, but in an aliyah, or things being done in a house, or things being done in an attic, or things being done in somebody's house. The fact that these are taking place in sort of domestic settings is actually very telling about the presence or lack of an institution. I think the earliest stages actually lack institutions. So we have to think in these early primordial periods about how Jewish life could have been sustained in the absence not just of the temple, but of institutions. Maybe there were institutions, I just don't know what they were. And I don't know what our evidence is for them.
But Rabbi Akiva's students, talking 12,000 students.
I'm not saying
that could be conjecture. But
so the question is, when and at what point in history do we begin to hear numbers like that? The answer is very late, way later than Rabbi Akiva.
Right.
So how many students would Rabbi Akiva have had historically? It's a good question. I actually have to research this. I don't know the answer. But assume it was a couple dozen. So the answer is going to be they could have learned in somebody's home, they could have learned in a synagogue, they could have learned some, meaning as we saw last week, one of the central activities that goes on in a shul is Talmud Torah. And that's an important point. So what I'd like to do now is figure out, even if we can't sort of reconstruct a prehistory of what sort of went on in an early period, at the very least, by the turn of the era, we know that there were institutions. We don't know what we haven't defined them tightly yet, but we know there were institutions. So last week we said, in the institution of the synagogue, in a building like a synagogue, what would have gone on? Well, prayer and Talmud Torah. Those are and perhaps some other things, but those are the two core functions that we have for, at least religious functions that we have for a shul in sort of the early Second Temple period, post-Second Temple period, and so on and so forth. So now we have to ask ourselves, if we want to talk about how seating was arranged in those synagogues, I mean, as we saw last week, the way seating can be identified, the way seating took place in a synagogue, and this is one has become some of the archaeological criteria for identifying a synagogue in the archaeological record, is that you have benches on the side of the walls, and they all face towards the middle. And then someone in the middle does whatever, or someone at the end of the hall does whatever. So in other words, in a room like this, you would have had benches on this side, and you would have had benches on this side, and then everybody would be looking towards the middle, or perhaps facing towards the Aron, which is over here, right? So that is what so we know that these are buildings that had seating. So where did people sit, and who sat there? Those are big questions. So the first thing we have to ask ourselves were there women in the synagogue? How can we answer this? So how would we go about answering this question? So we can't. So would archaeology help us here? Probably not. I'm going to argue at the end that it can, but the short answer is no. The short answer is no. Why not?
Once you have human remains in the synagogue, and you can identify them as women.
Yeah.
But how do you know they were praying there as opposed to being buried there? So
yeah, exactly. That meaning, and it'd be unlikely. In other words, unless I've given some boring drushes in my lifetime, but very, very infrequently do people actually die in the middle of my drushes from boredom. So the likelihood of being able to find an actual corpse in a synagogue in one of the benches and being able to identify it then as a woman, very remote. The other possibility is to find a place labeled, you know, women's section, right? But also, first of all, haven't found one, and second of all, it's unlikely that something like that would have been found anyway or would survive anyway. Our women's section is not labeled as a women's section nowadays. The shul I grew up in didn't label its women's section. It's understood. The women know where to go, the men know where to go, and that's how we sort of do things in our community. Very infrequently have I seen, if ever, I can't even remember a single time, where I see a sign above the women's section that says Ezra's Nashim, or women's section, something like that. Ah, right. So, right, so that Borough Park will be an easy community to excavate however many years from now, so that'll be helpful. But the first thing we have to ask ourselves is, how can we figure out if there were women in the shul? So I want to direct your attention to the first set of sources on this source sheet. The way that we can identify whether or not there were women in the synagogue is either through narrative contexts or through halachic contexts. And I've given you an example of both. The first one actually comes from an early witness, really one of the earliest witnesses to Judaism in the first century of the Common Era, possibly... I mean, really, in some respects at least, a very reliable witness because it's contemporaneous, although in other respects it may be unreliable because it has a very clear and obviously biased agenda, is the New Testament, or at least some of the New Testament. In this case, we're looking at the Book of Acts. The Book of Acts is probably written by around the end of the late first century of the Common Era. There's some who argue a little bit later than that. We can sort of accept it's the late first century of the Common Era. The Book of Acts tells us the following. It tells us about the arrival of Paul in a place called Philippi. And there he travels to the synagogue, which, and the word for the synagogue there, as we saw last week, is the same word that was used 400 years earlier in Alexandria, as Praseuche, which means place, to repeat means place of prayer. So on the Sabbath, we went outside the city gate to the river, where we expected to find a synagogue, a presochein. We sat down and began to speak to the women who had gathered there. There we go. Paul goes into a shul, and what does he find there? Women. So we know, at least in this context, in this place, Paul had encountered women in a synagogue. And it doesn't seem to have been something incredibly remarkable to him. It's just who he encountered there. It seems to be quite normal. Take a look at the source to the right of that. This is from the Tosefta. The Tosefta is put together probably the mid to late 3rd century of the Common Era, so a couple hundred years later, but the Tosefta also preserves very early material. So, however you want to date this piece of material, take it for what it is. The Hakol Olin Laminyan Shiva, Filo Isha, Filo Katan, In Mavinas Isha Likros Larabin. This is a famous source. For other reasons, it has obvious contemporary valence when we're discussing partnership minyanim and other sorts of halachic issues. Like that, which are popular in contemporary Pesach, but we as historians can use it for another purpose, which is to say, the assumption of this source is what? Meaning everyone can get an aliyah. So who's going to be in shul to get an aliyah? Men, women, and children. The assumption is that all of these people are in the shuls, and so much so that the Tosefta has to stipulate when it promulgates its gezeira that women are not to lane and get their and consequently get their aliyos, the Tosefta says that women are not to do this because you don't bring women to do this berabim among many people. The very fact that the Tosefta has to stipulate this, I think, is a clear hint that there were women in the shul, and that was the reason this needed to be stipulated. So here we have two sources. Temporally separated, but within a very reasonable range, I think, that tell us that there were women in the shul. So what's the next question we have to ask? If we're interested in the machitza, where do they sit? And how can we know where? And how can we know? How can we figure out the answer to that question? So again, figuring out the answer to this question is going to require
the
us...
The implication, if they could always also be called to the other, why would you assume that they would be seated as empty? I mean, if they could do the same as men, not laying, but calling up,
would you assume they could... The people who had the Eliyahu would laying also... At that time, it went hand in hand, I believe. But,
yeah, know. Right. So that's the Tosefta is imagining that whoever has an Aliyah would also read their portion of the Torah. That's the halachic reality that Tosefta is is assuming. Now,
but if you're saying that
the
women can't read,
well, it's not that they can't read. It's not that they can't read. They're not permitted to. Right. They're not permitted to. The assumption is that they... that's actually an important point that Dr. Schwarzbaff is raising. There's an assumed high degree of literacy here, which itself is remarkable. But it's worth pointing out.
How many women were educated in the...
It's an interesting question. There are books have been written about this. In other words, what would people have known to do in this... in this time period? It's a good question.
There are two reasons why they may not have a woman.
Yeah.
One of them may be that they didn't have the education that the men had, and therefore it didn't bring them up because they weren't educated to do it rather than...
Right. So I guess you could... In other words, one way to read the Tosefta is maybe to say there's no point in bringing women. I think the normative way that the text has been read, and I think this is the pshat, is you're not allowed to, even though they could technically. But just to move beyond this a second, I think at the very least what we can establish based on these sources is that there seems to be this common agreement and this common acknowledgement that if you're going into a shul in an early period, it's a reasonable expectation that you'll find all sorts of people there, men and women alike. Now the question is, that being the case, where did everybody sit? Maybe everybody sat together, but we have to ask ourselves, based on the available evidence, we're going to look at basically all of the evidence now, we have to ask ourselves, should these sources be interpreted? What do they say? And as I always say, most importantly, what do they not say? Yes?
Actually, because you brought the literacy issue,
yeah.
It is uncommon that you mentioned we have a high degree of literacy. Is it possible that things change because the whole concept of Chazara Hashas is because people couldn't read? Didn't they bring in...
Well, right. So in other words, Chazaras HaShatz may also be about people who came late.
Meaning, wasn't there a Chaz?
Jews come late.
Right. but in other words, you're right. In other words, the assumption is that anyone who's getting an Aliyah is going to be able to read. The Tosefta contemplates that there are women and children who would know how to do this as well. The question of how many people knew how to do this, that's a separate question. But at the very least, the assumption is that there are some men, women, and children who would know how to do this.
My question was, do you think maybe the way things about, maybe we can't know the answer, but maybe Chazar HaShav is only, maybe originally people were illiterate, then Chazar HaShav had to come in because people became illiterate.
Good question. Good question. When we deal with I'm glad you asked that. We're going to deal with the evolution of tefillah in, I think, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. But it's on the agenda, so let's put that in our back pocket for now. That's an excellent, excellent question. Now, take a look at the set of sources in source number 2. We're going to look at the first one on the left, which is from Philo. We looked at another part of this source, not anything that's listed here, another part of this source last week. We're going to come back to it now. What Philo is doing here is he is presenting to his readership, and the assumption I think is that the assumption that should be made here is that he's playing here mainly to a Gentile readership. And what he's doing is he's describing a particular group of Jews who are remarkable to Philo, that are present in his community called the Therapeutai. And the Therapeutai are this abstemious and pious group of people whom Philo seems to admire, and he describes at length the way that they practice Judaism, and he implies, and in some cases explicitly compares them and contrasts them with the great thinkers that would have been present in Greco-Roman life or in Alexandria and so on and so forth. So this is part of his presentation of what the Therapeutai do when they get together. So let's read this source very closely. It says certain things, it doesn't say other things, and we have to think logically about what were Philo's goals in writing what he writes as we're about to read it, and can we extrapolate from what Philo writes to perhaps other cases. So let's read. Philo says, "And this common holy place to which the therapeutai all came together on the seventh day on Shabbos, is a twofold circuit, being separated partly into the apartment of the men, and partly into a chamber for the women. For women also, from habit, form a part of the audience, having the same feelings of admiration as the men. And the wall which is between the houses rises from the ground 3 or 4 cubits upward, like a battlement, and the upper portion rises upwards to the roof without any opening on 2 accounts. First of all, in order that the modesty which is so becoming to the female sex may be preserved, and secondly, that the women may be easily able to comprehend what is said, being seated within earshot, since there is then nothing which can possibly intercept the voice of him who is speaking. So what is Philo imagining here? Philo is imagining what sounds like a synagogue, or at least a place where they congregate to pray and to learn and so on and so forth. And in this room, there is a side for men and a side for women, and there's a what sounds like a division between them, and it sort of goes off up from the ground 3 or 4 cubits, and it's opaque. However, it doesn't sound like it reaches the ceiling. In other words, it goes a little bit off the ground, and then there's open space above that. Why? So what does Philo say is the purpose of this? Sound. In other words, they were concerned that the women should be able to hear, right?
It seems like there's a balcony also.
So where do you see the balcony?
When it said that the boys in the room.
It wouldn't need to go upward to the roof if there weren't perhaps some balcony, because it was the modesty.
Right. In other words, they're concerned for modesty, but they're also concerned that people should hear. And the question is, how do they navigate between those two things? So the answer that they seem to come up with is that they have a separation, but not one that's so high that you can't. In other words, you basically have two different rooms, right? That's the solution they came up with. Now, what can we say based on this source? Well, we can say one thing for sure, and women were there. That's also true. In other words, there were certainly women in this particular place of worship.
And they were separate.
And they were separate. Now, should we... Well, this allows us to say one thing. It allows us to say that it is not true that men and women never separated in early Judaism. That we can certainly, I think, dispense with on the basis of this source alone, just to say here we have a context. In early Judaism in Egypt, where men and women were worshiping, you know, were davening together, doing Talmud Torah together, and they sat separately. Okay. Should we extrapolate from this source to other sources? In other words, should we say on this basis, well, that means men and women sat separately in other contexts as well, non-therapeutic contexts? Why or why not?
Well, the therapeutic may not have been the norm of the people.
Excellent.
Maybe, like in a minority practice.
Excellent. So maybe we should argue that since the therapeutai were particularly pious, maybe we would even call them sectarian. So because they're sectarian, we would be hesitant to extrapolate from this group to what we might call the mainstream. So we say everybody else sat together.
Sectarian.
Right. So that's how we would describe. That's how we would describe the therapeutai. In other words, the therapeutai are this weird, idiosyncratic group, and they're trying to separate between men and women. Now, why might we maybe reject that? In other words, what would cause us to reject that?
What was the norm of society in those days? Did men and women mix in society?
Excellent, excellent point. In other words, What are other people doing? First of all, we can ask that question about Jews in general. We can also ask that question about non-Jews. In other words, did non-Jews separate or not separate? It's an excellent question.
If you go back to Ahasuerus and Vashti, they had separate parties.
Ah, right. There's a Mishtei Nashim, right?
100 years before that, but I'm saying is that...
But there are roots. But you're right. There are roots of this in cultures that Jews are drawing their traditions from. It's an excellent point. There's a Mishtei Nashim, right? There's a party for women. Now, let's think about the context that within which Philo is writing here. Philo is trying to make a certain point about what this separation accomplished, which we mentioned already, which is Right? The separation that happened, modesty,
and he admires it.
And he admires it. But what other feature of this separation does he point out?
That they can hear.
So there are two things that are remarkable about it, and they point in different directions. First of all, there's modesty, and second of all, there's ease of hearing, right? Now, if what is most remarkable to Philo is the modesty of the therapeutae, then what would we expect would be true about the Hamonam, right, the rest of the people? Maybe they weren't as modest as the therapeutae, so maybe they didn't have separations between men and women. But if what's remarkable to Philo is their insistence on ease of access for the women, then perhaps we might want to extrapolate the opposite, which is to say the rest of the people made a much bigger separation between men and women than the therapeutae. And the therapeutae are remarkable because they're encouraging this sort of equal participation of men and women, or at least as equal as they can possibly get to under the circumstances. That's what the therapeutae want. So this is actually a rather ambiguous piece of evidence. The most we can say on this basis is that there is a group of Jews in this early period who separate men and women. Okay, that's what we have from Philo. Now take a look at the source to the right of that from Josephus. Now Josephus is describing something that the Mishnah will also go on to describe, and that is the presence in the Beis HaMikdash of the following architectural structure. He says, within this court was the sacred court. In other words, within the temple proper was the sacred court, which women were forbidden to enter, and still farther within was a third court into which only priests were permitted to go. Right? So in other words, the Beis HaMikdash has a couple of sections. There's the Ezras Nashim, there's the place where there's the women's section. Then there's the men's section beyond that, and then beyond that is the temple proper, is the Heichal proper, into which only Kohanim can go. So this would suggest to us what? I mean, the most obvious thing it suggests to us is that men and women were separated. Now, why? What might militate against that conclusion? Who can go into the women's section? We're going to see in the next source the Chazam make this explicit. Everyone can go into the Ezras Nashim. In fact, in some cases, everyone has to be in the Ezras Nashim. So the fact that there is a women's court doesn't necessarily imply that people are being separated. It just tells us that there are certain places where certain people can go, and that's the bottom line. Moreover, we might wish to say, even if you want to say that a women's section means that men and women are separated, so we shouldn't assume that means that in a synagogue, we might not want to extrapolate from the temple to the synagogue. Maybe things were done a certain way in the Beis HaMikdash, but in the shul, you could do whatever you want. In the shul, men and women wouldn't have been separated in much the same way that we don't separate between Yisraelim and Kohanim. Kohanim and Yisraelim, men, sit together, so too men and women sit together. Maybe we would want to extrapolate that from what Josephus is saying. I think that the one thing that we can certainly take away from Josephus is that the fact that there is a place that is designated specifically for women implies that at least there is a havamina, or a concept, that in certain cases there are places where there will be women, and there are at least places where there will be men, but there will not be women. In other words, it's true, everybody can get together in the Ezras Nashim, the women's section, but there are places where there will only be men and not women, just as there are places where there will only be Kohanim and not non-priests. And moreover, the question that we have to ask ourselves is it appropriate to extrapolate from the Beis HaMikdash to the Shul? That's a question that actually is going to last until the very end of this class. Yes?
I'm saying that it's just... They were there, even in the Beis HaMikdash.
Absolutely.
So that is what this point is important to show, that if we extrapolate that they were in the Beis HaMikdash, then it's likely that they were in the shuls also, that they were...
Absolutely, that's another important point. In other words, if women are in the Beis HaMikdash, they're probably in other major institutions. I mean, Kal Vachomer, if they're in the Beis HaMikdash, women are everywhere, right? Of course. And I think we should take this for granted. One of the things that we've seen here is that... in many respects, there's no gender separation in terms of who is eligible to be in these places. I mean, everybody's there. Everybody's in the synagogue. Everybody's in the Beis HaMikdash. The question is, what do they do when they get there? That's an excellent point. So take a look at the source to the at the source below Josephus. I've given you here a Mishnah, and the Hebrew text that I've given you is from a manuscript. It's a very famous manuscript of the Mishnah. It's generally taken, although there's an important person in Eretz Yisrael. His name is Robert Brody, Yerachmiel Brody, if he's writing Svarim, who was questioned whether this is the best manuscript to use. But by and large, people take this as this is called the Kaufman manuscript. It's an excellent manuscript of the Mishnah, and it's also vocalized, so it has nekudos. So it gives us a good tradition of how to read the Mishnayos. So the Mishnah tells us as follows: the chalaka haisa barishona. Vehikifua ketzotzra shanashim rawas milmala v'hanashim milamata kedei shelo yehu meuravin. This is talking again about the Ezras Nashim, the women's section, and it says originally the Mishnah tells us originally the walls of the women's section were unadorned, they were smooth, and later, however, in the women's section itself, they actually erected a balcony. They made a balcony so that the women would look on from above, while the men would be below, so that they should not be mixed. So there are two things that we see here. One, everyone's in the women's section. Everyone's in the Ezras Nashim. However, and also, originally, men and women were congregating together in the Ezras Nashim. The context here is somewhat unclear, but the Tosefta clarifies that the context here is at the Simchas Beis HaShoeva on Sukkis. It's one of this very joyous time, and also a time of great partying, mingling, wild abandon, everybody's dancing together, everybody's celebrating together, a real party atmosphere. Men and women would originally have been together until Chazal instituted the plan that a balcony should be built in the Ezras Nashim so that the men and women would be separated. Now, again, we have the same dilemma. On the one hand, this source clearly tells us that at least in rabbinic literature, in the period when the Mishnah is written, so the early 3rd century, maybe even earlier, but most conservative estimate by the 3rd century, there are Jews who are taking it for granted that in the Beis HaMikdash, at least eventually, men and women are separate. There's a women's section, a balcony, and then there are the men down below. We have to be careful, however, as we said earlier, about the following problem. This is describing the Beis HaMikdash. Do we really want to say that whatever happened in the Beis HaMikdash happens in shuls also? Based on what we saw last week, we should be concerned about this. In other words, last week we saw that there isn't a clear analog, at least in its earlier stages, between the shul as it develops and the Beis HaMikdash. If there isn't a clear analog, then maybe we shouldn't say that whatever happened in the Beis HaMikdash happens in the shul. As the shul develops, we'll see this more in the coming weeks, as Chazal and as the Jewish people begin to conceive, especially after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, begin to conceive of the shul more and more as a Mikdash Mat, as a temple in miniature, this question becomes even more fraught, because once you see the shul as an analog for the Beis HaMikdash, then it becomes more logical to say, well, whatever happened in the Beis HaMikdash should happen in shuls. And as we're going to see, this becomes actually an important point in contemporary Pesach. But it's clear that at least for Chazal, there was certainly a requirement in the Beis HaMikdash that men and women worship separately. One last source that I want to look at before we move on to the archaeology is from the New Testament. The New Testament tells us the following, and here I think we actually have to be very careful. New Testament tells us as follows. This is from Luke, so a little bit earlier than the source in Acts that we read before. On Shabbos, Jesus was teaching in one of the synagogues, and a woman was there who had been crippled by a spirit for 18 years. She was bent over and couldn't straighten up at all. When he saw her, he addressed her, and the word there is prosophonesen, which means he. So some translate it as he called her over, which makes it sound like she was coming over from another section. But really, what prosophonesen means just means is he addressed her. So he addressed her, and he said to her, "Woman, you are set free from your infirmity." Then he put his hands on her, and immediately she straightened up, and so on and so forth. Indignant because he had healed on the Sabbath, the synagogue leader said to the people, "There are 6 days for work, so come and be healed on those days, not on the Sabbath." Okay, the obvious polemical overtones of the source notwithstanding, there are certain, I think, conclusions that we can draw from parts of the story that we have no reason to suspect are untrue. And in particular, well, the most obvious one is that who was in the shul? Men and women, right? And if you are of a particular religious persuasion, deities, right? Those are everybody's in the shul. From our perspective, false messiahs. That's neither here nor there. So everybody's in the shul. Now, the question we have to ask ourselves is there anything about this source that can tell us one way or another where the women in this synagogue were sitting? So what do you think?
Well, so close, because he addresses her, she's a cripple, she can't get that far.
Ooh, good point, I hadn't even thought about that. Excellent point. Oh, excellent point. In other words, right, so he says to her, right, she's bent over, she can't straighten up at all, it sounds like she can't really get around so much. Right, so it certainly doesn't sound like she's in a balcony, it doesn't sound like she's anywhere. And as I said, although while some translate this passage as he called her over, which makes it sound like she was somewhere else and she walked over to him, the actual word prosiphonisen in Greek just means he addressed her. It doesn't have to mean she came from somewhere. So you're right, in other words, it sounds like she was close by.
How big these rooms are not that big.
Right, so we're gonna see. So we're gonna see in the next source. It's a good question. How big were these shuls?
If you look at ancient shuls, they were
Yeah, so we're going to see in the next source exactly what the size of one of the shuls we're going to be looking at was. That's an excellent point. Bear that in mind. How many people were here? And let's think about that. Let's think about that carefully. Here, another thing is, if separation of gender is sort of a mandatory part of synagogue life in this period, so there actually would have been two ways to attack Jesus. Right? The synagogue leader could have said, he healed on the Sabbath, and he's walking into the women's section. You can't just go into the women's section if that's not where you're supposed to be. There could have been multiple ways that he could have attacked Jesus.
He touches her.
There are a million things, right? There are a million things, right? Say, maybe it's not derechiba. Maybe that's why he doesn't care. But you're right. There are grounds upon which he could have attacked her. I'm skeptical. Now, all of these are suggestive. This source, I think, though, is ambiguous because I'm not convinced that this is proof positive that people were sitting together. There's nothing about this that tells us they must have been sitting separately in the same way that the source from the Mishnah that we saw, the source from Josephus that we saw, the source from Philo that we saw, those were all explicit that men and women were being separated. This is ambiguous. There are some suggestive things that they may have been sitting together, but there's nothing that compels us to say men and women were...
His hands on her shows the sense of connectedness as well.
Right. In other words, there certainly is a sense that women are accessible to the men in such a way that if you're a man in the synagogue, you can reach out and touch a woman in the synagogue. That's suggestive too. Yes.
Couldn't this all be exaggerated? Because I personally don't believe that Jesus put his hands on her and she was healed.
Correct. Neither do I. Right.
So like all the other issues, like, did he really go over to her? Did he?
Right. So another Michelle's point is important. There's another point here that needs to be made, which is that the polemical context here is, and the agenda, I think, is quite obvious. Now, there's such a clear interest in this text in portraying sort of a miracle and sort of a group of people gathered around a miracle worker, and the miracle worker picks someone out of the crowd and works a miracle on them. So, in other words, that may be what's driving the all of the imagery of proximity and reaching out and being able to touch someone. That may be a part of this also. We have to be very wary about the context. Yes.
I feel like the main point of Luke's passage is saying, and then the leader of the synagogue wasn't even happy that she got healed. His main focus was Shabbos. I feel like the passage is trying to debunk Shabbos.
Exactly. That's another excellent point. In other words, we don't have to expect that we would have criticized Yeshu for calling someone over from the women's section, because that's not the point of this passage. The point of the passage, as you so rightly note, is to disparage to disparage a particular view of what it means to be Mechal al Shabbos. Not Shabbos in general, but of what it means to be Mechal al Shabbos. But yes, excellent.
As much as Luke was one of the few Gentiles, 70 years later, the surroundings, as opposed to his point.
Well, 40 years, but yes.
Okay. the surroundings that he's describing may just be, in his imagination, and because of his experiences in Ireland.
Right.
I forgot where he resided, Luke.
Right, so we don't know if Luke was, if the person named Luke who's accompanies, I'm not mistaken, is the physician who accompanies Paul. The idea that Luke is a person named Luke is the one who authored this gospel is very old, but it's a conjecture. It's a very, very ancient conjecture, but it's still a conjecture. We don't know who Luke was. All we know is that it's extremely likely that whoever authored, up for debate. In other words, the gospels all seem to come from Eretz Yisrael. The whoever authored Luke almost certainly also authored Acts. That's why some scholars refer to them as Luke Acts. But more than that, we don't know. What we do know about Luke is that it's the most like guyish of the Gospels. Matthew is the most frum, if I could put it that way, and Luke is the most guyish of the Gospels. So there are certain things you're going to only find in Luke, and for that matter, there are certain things you're only going to find in John, another Gospel like that you're not going to find, let's say, in Matthew or in Mark, which is Mark is the earliest of the Gospels. This is a suggestive source, but it's so fraught, I think, with methodological issues and ambiguities and just flat out fabrications that I think we have to be very skeptical or be very wary at least of using. So what I'd like to do now is turn to something that we can actually touch with our hands. In other words, let's look at some of the real archaeology. Let's get deep into the actual physical existence of a shul and ask ourselves: Is there any way that we can look at the archaeology, even conceding that we're not going to find something that says, here sat the women in this synagogue. Even if we're not going to find something like that, is there anything that we can recover from archaeology that can tell us one way or another about the seating practices in a shul? So take a look at the source I've given you in number 3, archaeological data. The plans of which I've given you here, the excavator's report from which I've excerpted here, is a synagogue in what Josephus calls Gischala. In Hebrew, we would call Gush Chalav. The shul in Gush Chalav, and I've given you a little timeline above that, is built be'erech, approximately in the year 250. It lasts until approximately the year 551, and it goes through 4 phases of occupation, which means there are 4 different stages in which it undergoes a major change, or in some cases in which it was destroyed and rebuilt, or in which parts of it were destroyed and other parts were added on. What I want to give you here is I've given you on the left-hand column those 2 shuls. One is I've sort of given you like an aerial sketch, and the other one is a reconstruction. So in other words, if you can look over here, this is the aerial view, and this over here is going to be the reconstruction. In Gush Chalav, it's in the Galil, if I'm not mistaken. Josephus's major enemy in the Jewish War, the person who is his antagonist, excellent, yes, Yochanan of Gush Chalav, excellent, yeah. John of Gischala is one of the major villains of Josephus's literature, which the vehemence with which he polemicizes against John of Gush Chalav indicates that he probably was someone we would have liked to know. But no judgment on Josephus either way. Josephus gets a bad rap. But what are the things that we can learn about what happened in this shul between the phase that I've given you over here on the left-hand side and the phase on the right-hand side? Now, just in terms of what I've shown you, the phase on the left-hand side over here is what the shul looked like in period 1. That's, if you look at your timeline, between 250 and about 306 of the Common Era. 306 is a big earthquake. After that, the shul is rebuilt in period 2, and then again in 3 and 4. Now, sometime between period 2 and period 4, so sometime between 306 and 551, the shul begins to look like the way it looks in the right-hand column. What changes between period 1 and the next few periods? So let's take a look. Over here, I'm just going to lay out for you what the shul looked like. Right? The shul is laid out over here on north is sort of pointing to the top. The top of the page is the north side. The bima is on the southern wall here on the bottom. It's a little square. It's hard to make out, but it's a little square. On the sides, on either sides, on the extreme sides are extra rooms, right? Extra rooms. The way you get into the shul from the street is on the north corner right over here. And these little dots right, four on each side of the room, those are columns, right? Those are columns separating you on either side. And it's also hard to make them out, but aligning the walls on the east and the west side, right, on the long sides of the shul, are benches. That's where people would sit. Just like Philo told us. Philo told us there were benches in the shuls of the Therapeutae. There are also benches in all other shuls. Yes? Oh, that's another... Oh, it's a weird thing. That's another entrance. That's another entrance. You're right. Excellent question. Right next to the bima is another place that you get into the shul. Now, this wall, this north wall right over here, this is the northernmost part of the shul for about 50 years, right? That's what the shul looks like. Then there was a centennial,
building campaign.
There was a building campaign, right, exactly. There was a major capital campaign. Funds were raised. Many Yom Kippur appeals were successful. And then the new Irma and Joseph Reinstein wing was added in period two, right? So in period two, what changes? Let me ask: what changes in period two? What looks different in or at least sometime after period one? What looks different on the right hand side?
Is this the balcony?
Excellent, excellent point. We're going to get to that in just a moment. But what is the balcony? So in other words, what looks different? If you have to identify what's been added.
The north side.
There's now a new wall along the north side. The wall that was the original end of the shul in period one is now no longer the northernmost part of the shul. Now there's a new wall there. And if you'll notice, along the east side, there's another room. Okay, but fine. What I want to concentrate is on that northernmost wall. What was that northernmost wall and what did it do?
Wall or the area?
Well, good question. That's actually a machlokas archaeologist, right? So the archaeologists who the excavators who worked on this shul have a series of different reconstructions about what this wall would have meant. Based on this whole long arichus, we're not going to get into it now, based on a whole long arichus, which is incredibly thorough and also very convincing, the way that they've reconstructed the shul to look like, and I think this is an excellent bit of archaeology, is what you see over here in this picture on the bottom right. If you'll notice, the copy isn't fantastic.
It's stairs, which is why I said it would go up.
Yeah, right, exactly. So in other words, you'll see there's the main area of the shul in between all of the columns, and then the very back, there are these smaller columns. Tops of them are, if you can make it out, are shaped like hearts. The excavators call them the heart-shaped columns. They're smaller, and so the fact that they're smaller means that they still have to reach the top of the ceiling, but there has to be a higher floor beneath them, right? So that's why what this second wall, this northernmost wall, is actually supporting is the facade that allows for the creation of what Mrs. Falk told us is actually a balcony, right? So there's a balcony in the back. Now, can we identify this as a women's balcony? We have a balcony to our right over here. Was the balcony in this shul, like this balcony, is the place where women sat? Why or why not? Or maybe we don't know. So someone want to argue for yes, no, or we don't know. It could have been the Spanish Portuguese, right? It could have been S&P, right? That's maybe where the choir is. So now, the choir, we would if there was a choir, I don't know if there were choirs in this period. I don't think we have any evidence one way or another. You would have expected them to sit in the front, right? You would have expected them to sit where the bima is. So this is all the way in the back of the shul. Now, so who wants to make the case for yes, no, or maybe so?
I would say it's probably for women.
Why?
Because we the other places where we talked about, there was a balcony they erected for women.
Right, so we know from the Mishnah that where would women sit if there is a women's section? In a balcony, right? Now, you might want to make the case for no, or at least maybe so, by saying, well, the balcony could just be for anybody. Why would you add... In other words, let's say the shul is damaged after period one. Now, it's been 50 years on, the rabbi is doing his job, and now you have a bunch of, there's nice day schools in the area, you have young couples moving in, so what problems are you going to face if you're a small shul? Space, right? You need more space.
So what was a successful membership campaign?
Excellent. So what I want to ask is Mr. Comet's question, and I want to answer it with an insight that Dr. Schwartzbaum had before. We might want to suggest, and by the way, historians have suggested as a response to Naomi's point, it's not a women's section. Why? It's just, at least we don't know it's a women's section. It could just be, the likelihood is that it's an overflow section. too much, there's not enough space, we need an overflow, right? Now, why would we be suspicious? Why should we be suspicious of this? Dr. Schwartzbaum asked the question before, which is not just an excellent question, but an entire book has been published recently called Ancient Synagogue Seating Capacities, I think, designed to answer the question of how can we know, so people have a lot of time in their hands, how can we know who sat where in the shul and how many people were there in the shul? Now, there's an algorithm for this. According to our best estimate, the number of people that would have fit in the space in the main area, which is the entire shul of period one, and the main area of period two, is 160 people. Now, you can actually just eyeball it by looking at the balcony, but I'll give you the answer. How many people would have fit in the balcony? 14. Right? Now, you have a shul that has 160 seating capacity. You have a great membership campaign. You have a great appeal. You have a great day school. We're going to build a whole new wing for 14 people. Right? That doesn't make any... To me, that makes no sense. If you want... Now, we don't know that there were more men in ancient synagogues than there were women. So I am making an assumption in saying that there would have been few enough women that this balcony could have accommodated them. So let's be aware of that assumption. But I think it's quite unreasonable to say that this is an overflow section, because if it was an overflow section, it was a very poorly done overflow section. And to go to all this trouble just to get an extra 14 people in shul, it seems to me excessive or insufficient as an explanation.
You've got to go all the way, not just on the north side, but also on the east side.
Right, so these east sides, so you're right. On the east side, there are extra rooms, but those rooms are not connected to the sanctuary. So I don't know if we can say that there were people who were davening as part of the minyan that were in there. Now, so I want to argue that it's actually quite plausible to suggest, based on the Mishnah, based on the other sources that we have from Josephus and Philo, that this was actually a women's section. Now, what this tells us is two things.
10% of the women have only 10% of
you're right.
The seats.
Sorry, so Dr. Kaufman is right. I'm also making an assumption that there were fewer women in the synagogue than there were men.
Not fewer, I mean, where that, many, many times.
Yeah, that fewer. In other words, only 14, right? In other words,
10%.
You're right, that they would have been 10%. That is an assumption that I'm making. I'm not sure that it's an unjustified assumption, but you're right, it's an assumption that I'm making. We need to be aware of it.
Is
yes.
It possible the balcony, like over here, had more than one row on it, so it could have been 14?
Yeah, in other words, I think the amount of people that this space could have accommodated, if you assume the algorithm that I haven't laid out for you, but if you assume it, is 14 people altogether. Now, another possibility is that there was also a machitza in the main area, and we just hasn't survived. It was made of wood or it was made of cloth. We have no way of knowing one way or another. But we should be aware also, there are certain obvious ways that separations along the lines of what we've seen in the sources that we have could have been erected, and we would just have no way of knowing based on the archaeology. Our archaeology is biased towards things that were made out of stone and pottery and so on and so forth. So we should be aware of that too. Now, what we can actually discern two things based on this. One, from period two and onward, it's possible, maybe even probable, maybe even highly likely that there was a women's section, that this shul was separating men and women. But another thing that we can say is that it's also possible that in the earlier shul, they weren't doing so, and they changed. Right? They changed and they evolved towards this minhag. So what all of the foregoing, I think, should make us aware of is the great diversity that we can find in ancient shuls. But we can also see, I think, the tendency in the literature of Chazal. We don't have time to explore this fully, but Chazal manifests this tendency to talk about separations, to envision separations, especially in the Beis HaMikdash, but also in other contexts as well. And that stuff is present in Josephus as well. But we should be aware that this is a very diverse environment, and Chazal, in many respects, when they're talking about separate seating, are trying to sort of impose some sort of order, or some sort of systematization on a great deal of chaos within Jewish practice. Now, the reason I want to highlight this is for you to take a look at that very last source. We're just going to breeze through it very quickly because we've run out of time. And that is a tshuva from Rav Moshe. The way that Rav Moshe, at the height of the Mechitza controversies of yesteryear, the way that Rav Moshe Feinstein describes the requirement to have a Mechitza is as follows. He says, So you can read the translation on the right, but to summarize what Rav Moshe just said, yes, Rav Moshe is saying that not only is there a requirement for separate seating, but separate seating is insufficient. You actually need a physical mechitza. And not only do you need a physical mechitza, but that the requirement to have that physical mechitza is biblical, is midaraisa. So then Rav Moshe has this is just the beginning of the tshuva. Rav Moshe has several long tshuvas where he lays out his argument. It's based on a Gemara in the Bavli that discusses that Mishnah that we quoted. And it's a very interesting tshuva. But what I want to highlight is not to sort of explore the nuances of Rav Moshe Feinstein's claims. That's for a shiur on contemporary Pesach. What I want to highlight here is that there is an easy, lazy way of viewing what Rav Moshe is doing is saying, well, the way Pesach used to work is that everybody, there was a common minhag of the Jewish people, everybody did the same thing, they followed the leaders, and now we have this whole hodgepodge of practice, and Rav Moshe is trying to impose his will on such a diversity of practice by making everything seem systematic when really there's this great diversity. Why don't we just live and let live? Let's have a world where there's some Orthodox shuls that don't have mechitza, some that do. This was the rhetoric of the early period of the mechitza of the height of the mechitza controversies. Let's just have rabbis. Some rabbis can be an Orthodox rabbi in a shul without a mechitza. You can be an Orthodox rabbi in a shul with a mechitza. Big deal. I think one of the things that we've seen is that that's actually not the way that halacha functioned once upon a time. It's not the way Jewish society ever functioned. There's the idea that Jewish society ever functioned in a way where there was sort of no diversity. There was just this sort of obedient public that followed the leaders is a myth. What we've seen here is that there actually was, from the very beginning, this incredible diversity of practice and also competing visions of what the shul was. The shul was either modeled on the Beis HaMikdash, it was a Mikdash Ma'at, or the shul was a Pres Elchei, it was something totally separate from the Beis HaMikdash. Some shuls had separate seating, some shuls did not. Some sources claim that there was lots of separate seating, other sources imply that maybe there wasn't. Some shuls, as we saw in Gush Chalav, maybe had separate seating for their entire existence. Maybe they didn't originally, but they eventually evolved it. There's this incredible diversity of practice, and it's upon this diversity that Chazal are training their gaze. And the project of Chazal is not to lead the people and tell people what to do. Chazal are actually doing very much, I think, what Poskim are doing today, which is they're looking at a chaos or a chaotic mess, I think, of practice where people don't always listen to Chazal, where people don't always listen to Rabbanim and to Poskim and to Jewish leaders, to Yoatzot and so on and so forth. And what they're looking at, they're saying, is we have to impose, or not impose is the wrong word, we actually have to demonstrate what a halachic ideal would look like. They're working with an ideal, a sort of independent notion of what halacha and Torah values dictate that society should look like, and they're using their powers of persuasion, their powers of authority or otherwise, to try and figure out how to bring our divided and chaotic community up to what that ideal should look like. And I think that's actually the model for how Pesach works nowadays, and it's also, I think, it's also representative of how Jewish practice and Jewish halachic decision making worked once upon a time in the earliest periods for which we have evidence. So I think that if we can figure out what all of this discussion means for us today, it's that we should be confident, I think, that the atmosphere that we have today for Pesach in multiple directions actually works in a fashion that it's worked for many thousands of years, which is to say that, first of all, there is a great deal of diversity, and we should recognize it, and we should appreciate it. But also, we should recognize that the idea of Chazal, of Jewish leadership, having to deal with a crowd that doesn't always listen to it, and having to figure out ways to demonstrate the beauty and the independence and the objective value of a halachic system is also nothing new. And I think that we should have confidence in although it seems today like we're in the midst of a crisis of halachic decision-making, I think we should be confident that just as Chazal weathered the storm and ended up creating and ended up carrying forward an incredible masora of halachic practice, we should be confident as well, I think, in our, at least reasonably confident, in our the way that our halachic system is functioning. Yes, and with that I will conclude. Everyone is dismissed, but but I'd like
to... Biblical law, would that tend to lead less to chaotic diversity?
Right, so Rav Moshe is making his argument based on the way the Bavli develops the Mishnah that we saw. The Bavli says that by what warrant were the rabbis allowed to create an extra architectural structure in the Beis HaMikdash? They weren't explicitly told to do. They did it based on a pasuk in Zechariah. But based on that, Rav Moshe reasoned that there was a biblical requirement to have a machitza, because otherwise, how could the rabbis have done what they did? The question of whether or not it is a biblical requirement, or whether perhaps it's something else that's equally binding, is interesting as a matter of 20th century psak. It's something I don't know if we have time to get into here, but what we can, but I think, listen, even something that would have been biblical law, like for instance Tumah Vatara, even if it's biblical law, arguing about what the details would look like is something that would even produce chaos in that respect. Look at the rabbis and look at the Dead Sea Scrolls. But yes, that's an excellent point. All right, yeah, Shikawach, everyone.